Les conférences du Collège de France.
So good afternoon, everyone. It's a real pleasure and an honor to welcome Tony Hunter for this series of lectures invited by the Board of Directors of the Collège de France. So Tony will be giving four lectures on his work. It's almost embarrassing to present Tony Hunter, who is a living legend. Tony got his PhD from the University of Cambridge in 69 and then moved on to the Salk Institute, where he's been staying ever since as a professor of biochemistry. The first piece of work that made Tony extremely well known is the discovery of tyrosine phosphorylation and its role in controlling the cell cycle and more broadly cell growth. This work, as you all know, led to the discovery of kinase inhibitors, which are currently used in clinical medicine, such as Gleevec, that has changed the prognosis of chronic myelogenous leukemia. But more broadly, Tony has been ever since interested in post-translational modification of proteins and the way that these post-translational modifications can act as switch for protein function, switch for protein stability, protein localization. And Tony is an incredibly creative and biochemist with an immense culture, and I think that this immense culture will be made very apparent by this talk. So without any further ado, thank you very much for being here with you. This, by the way, is the official medal of the Collège de France, which I'm happy to give you in recognition for these lectures, and we're eager to hear about the protein phosphorylation. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Tony.
Thank you. So it's a great pleasure to be back in Paris, especially in the springtime, and to be able to give a course of lectures here at the Collège de France. So as the title implies, today I'm going to focus mainly on protein phosphorylation. But before I do that, I'd like to pay tribute to Roger Guillemin, a very eminent French scientist with whom I was a colleague at the Salk Institute for over 50 years. After he joined in 1970, he reached the grand age of 100 in January this year. Sadly, he died a few weeks later, but we were able to celebrate his life in science on his birthday, which was a wonderful occasion. And Catherine Rivier, who was in his group, myself and Ron Evans have written one of the many retrospectives on Roger Guillemin that has just come out in PNAS. So since this is the first lecture, I thought I would introduce myself a little bit. So I was born in Ashford in Kent, southeast England, in August of 1943. I went to a private preparatory school in Ashford, then I was sent away to a boarding school, which in England we call public schools, where basically my career in science was set. By the second month I was there, I was told I had to specialize in sciences, and that's what I've been doing ever since. From Felsted, I went to Caius College in Cambridge, which had been my father's college, and I got my BA in biochemistry in 1965. I was at a bit of a loss what to do next, but luckily someone in the department suggested that I should do a PhD in the department. And so I did my PhD with Asher Korner in the Department of Biochemistry. He was one, I think maybe the only faculty member in the department doing any sort of molecular biology in 1965, when it was clear molecular biology was going to be the future. After I got my PhD, I stayed on in Cambridge for 3 more years as an independent fellow in Christ College in Cambridge, working again in the Department of Biochemistry. They gave me funding to run a small group, and so I actually started independent research in 1968. From there, I went to the Salk Institute, where I currently am, to do postdoctoral studies. I didn't actually choose to go to the Salk Institute, but I followed my first wife, who was a fellow graduate student in the department, who wanted to do a postdoc at UCSD in La Jolla, and I ended up at the Salk Institute, something, of course, I don't regret. My wife and I split up when we were in California. It was California in the 1970s. And so I went back to Cambridge to look for a job in the UK, but no one offered me a position. Luckily, the Salk Institute was just beginning to expand its junior faculty, and I had been offered one of those positions, and I ended up back there again in February of 1975, where I have been a faculty member ever since. In fact, I arrived on February 25th, 1975, and so my 50th anniversary as a faculty member will be early next year. Now, contrary to popular belief, I haven't always had a beard. Here I am as a graduate student in 1965, beardless. Here is evidence that I actually did experiments as a student. I was eluting peptides from a chromatogram. This photograph was taken by my fellow graduate student, Tim Hunt, who went on to do amazing science and won the Nobel Prize in 2001. As I said, it was the 1970s, so even though I was in England, I began to grow my hair out, and here I am with long hair. However, by the time I came back from Cambridge to the UK, there had been an amazing transition to a true hippie. You can see I now have a long brown beard, and the story is that I started my beard at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. The last day I shaved was July the 15th, 1972, when I hiked down to join a rafting trip on the Colorado River, and I came out 2.5 weeks later with the makings of an embryonic beard, and I have not shaved since. When I came back to the US, I needed a green card to be admitted, and amazingly, they admitted this terrorist into the United States on February the 24th, 1975. Now, my beard will continue to feature throughout my four lectures, so just keep your eyes open. So this is my life path into science. I was born in Ashford in Kent, near Canterbury. Went to boarding school at Felsted in Essex, from there to Cambridge in Cambridgeshire. From there, as a postdoc to the Salk Institute, you can see Felsted was founded 460 years ago. Cambridge, something like 900 years ago, and the Salk Institute only in 1960. Back to Cambridge for a year, and then finally ended up in La Jolla in California. So with that brief introduction then, let's move on to post-translational modifications, which will be the theme of this series of lectures. This is a poster you can obtain from Cell Signaling showing the modifications or the functions, at least, of all 20 natural amino acids. 15 of these can be modified by actual covalent adducts. And you can see from this pie chart here that serine, threonine, and tyrosine generate over 3/4 of the known proteins that are modified by phosphorylation, whereas the other modifications are relatively minor. But I'll be talking about other modifications in my next lecture. So protein phosphorylation is the archetypal protein modification. It's a reversible modification. Not all post-translational modifications are reversible. But for those that are, the modification requires two enzymes, a writer enzyme, which adds the modification, in this case a protein kinase that uses the gamma phosphate of ATP to generate a phosphoprotein, commonly at serine, threonine, or tyrosine. But other amino acids can be phosphorylated, as I'll be telling you in my third lecture. And a second enzyme, in this case, an eraser, in this case, a protein phosphatase, which removes the phosphate. This step actually makes this process irreversible chemically. The phosphate cannot be added directly to proteins. In many cases, post-translational modifications are recognized by a third protein, a reader protein, which recognizes the phosphomodification in a sequence-dependent manner. Now, serine, threonine, and tyrosine create phosphate esters of this sort here, a POC bond. Now, as I'll tell you, phosphorylation was discovered nearly 140 years ago, and it is the most prevalent post-translational modification in eukaryotes, with up to 50,000 sites in a cell. So here's the history timeline. Olive Hammerston in 1883 reported that casein, the milk protein, contains phosphate, but he didn't show that it was covalently attached. And that was left to Levine and Alsberg, who in the second volume of JBC in 1906 reported the vitellin, the egg protein, contains covalently attached phosphate. It took them another 25 years to figure out how this phosphate was attached. And they showed, and this was actually the work of Fritz Lippmann, who was in Levine's lab at the time, but went on to be famous in metabolism, showed that it was linked to serine. But at the same time, they actually synthesized phosphoserine, phosphothreonine, and phosphotyrosine in case the phosphate was linked to one of the three hydroxy amino acids. The next major steps were the identification of protein kinase activities, and particularly phosphorylase kinase that phosphorylates the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme, and the cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, the seminal work of Ed Krebs and Eddie Fisher. Now, it may surprise you to know that the next phosphoamino acid to be discovered was phosphohistidine, which I'll be talking about in my third lecture. In 1962, the work of Paul Boyer and his colleagues showing that phosphohistidine was an enzyme intermediate. And then finally, through our work, we discovered that proteins can be phosphorylated on tyrosine, and I'll tell you the story in just a minute. But before I do that, let me talk a little bit about why phosphate was chosen to modify proteins. Now, Frank Westheimer, in a thought piece in Science in 1987, discussed why he thought nature chose phosphates, but focused entirely on nucleic acids, and why phosphate is the perfect compound to link the nucleoside units. He never even mentioned the possibility that phosphate would be important in as a protein modification. So I tried to remedy that in this article back in 2012, and I'll tell you some of the things that I concluded or discussed now. So I've already told you phosphorylation is clearly an important modification, of particularly of serine, threonine, and tyrosine. These phosphate esters are incredibly stable in solution, reported half-lives in buffer at pH 7 about a century. So these are incredibly stable compounds, even though they can be readily dephosphorylated. Stability of this type is not true for the other phosphoamino acids that I'll discuss. I think most importantly, the phosphoamino acids serve as new chemical entities on the surface of proteins. There is no natural amino acid that mimics a phosphoserine, threonine, or tyrosine. The phosphate group has a large hydrated shell and a greater than one negative charge, and that's illustrated here. You can see this is the size of the hydrated shell compared to the only two acidic amino acids, which have carboxylate groups, aspartate and glutamate, which have a single negative charge at pH 7, whereas phosphate monoesters commonly have about 1.5 negative charges or sometimes 2 negative charges. So in fact, for this reason, aspartate and glutamate, although commonly used as phosphomimic mutations, in fact, are usually very poor phosphomimics and only work in a few cases. Phosphoamino acids form stronger salt bridges with arginine than aspartate and glutamate, and more stable hydrogen bonding interactions. So I think it's these properties that allows phosphorylation to be important as a major modification that can then be recognized in a number of ways, but particularly by phospho-specific binding domains, which will not recognize aspartate and glutamate. And then, just as a heads up for the third lecture, phosphorylation can also occur on histidine, aspartate, glutamate, arginine, lysine, and cysteine. So what does phosphorylation do to a protein's activity or function. Well, it can induce a conformational change that leads to an increased or decreased activity, as shown originally by Ed Krebs and Eddie Fisher, who showed that phosphorylase modification of glycogen phosphorylase increases its activity significantly through an induced conformational change and tetramerization. Phosphate can also directly inhibit an enzyme by occupying the active site, or it can serve as a phosphoenzyme intermediate, as I'll be telling you in another lecture. It can also simply add charge to the surface of a protein and either decrease or increase interaction through a charge interface, but usually more commonly through protein domains that recognize phosphorylated residues. And these play key roles in signal transduction pathways. Now, another important feature of post-translational modifications in general and phosphorylation specifically is they can be used to increase the number of protein states or proteoforms. So we start out, all mammals, with about 20,000 coding genes. Through alternative splicing and starts and stops, one may be able to achieve around 70 to 100,000 different protein states. But if you now add in the possibility of combinatorial use of post-translational modifications, it's been estimated there might be as many as a million different protein states or proteoforms. And if you want to read a thoughtful analysis of this, you should look at this review by Abersold et al. Now, I've been telling you phosphorylation is a very prominent modification, but the numbers are actually huge. So in the PhosphoCyte Plus database, they currently list around 300,000 unique serine, threonine, and tyrosine phosphorylation sites in the human proteome, of which the majority are phosphoserine, somewhat less phosphothreonine, and somewhat less phosphotyrosine. Now, there are a lot of other modifications that I'll discuss next time. Now, whether all of these sites are genuinely functional, we don't know. And only a very small fraction of these has actually been validated as being a regulatory modification. Now, as I said, post-translational modifications can act as docking sites to induce protein-protein interactions, or PPIs. And so the phosphorylated tyrosine can be recognized by a Src homology 2 or an SH2 domain, a modular phosphobinding domain. Phosphothreonine and phosphoserine also have binding domains. Now, modular binding domains are extremely important, not only in phosphodependent interactions, but through in recognition of many other types of modification and also just short sequence motifs. But this set of modular domains are the ones that recognize phosphate in other proteins. These modular domains are between 50 and 200 amino acids in length, and they can be moved during evolution, as has been, you can just see by looking at the genome, to form a new phosphobinding protein or add phosphobinding activity to an existing protein. And these modifications then can lead to protein-protein interactions, which may transduce signals or may lead to subcellular translocation. So here's the very first example, which was the Src homology 2 domain bound to a short six amino acid peptide, where the phosphotyrosine is buried deep in this pocket interacting with an arginine, and the two glutamates on either side also interact. This is the structure from John Currien's lab. And I should say that we owe the idea that there are protein-protein interaction modular domains largely to Tony Pawson here, the late Tony Pawson, sadly, who discovered the Src homology 2 domain. And here are some examples of other structures. I've already shown you the SH2 domain that binds phosphotyrosine, but these are a series of phosphoserine and phosphothreonine binding domains. You can see there's a wide variety of structures that can selectively recognize phosphate in a sequence-dependent fashion, and I'll be mentioning this WW domain that binds phosphoserine proline in the last part of my lecture. So I thought, since this is sort of a historical part of my lecture, I would tell you how we stumbled across phosphotyrosine in 1979. So at the time, I was studying polyoma DNA tumor virus. It's a small DNA virus with a 5 kilobase pair genome, 6 genes. It's divided really functionally into two halves, an early half, which is transcribed and translated very soon after the virus enters the cell and gets to the nucleus, and a late region, which is transcribed and translated later to generate the coat proteins for the virus. And what we were working on was one of the three proteins that are made by the early region through alternative splicing, so-called T or tumor antigens. The middle T antigen was shown actually subsequent to this by François Cousin and Bob Kamen to be capable of transforming fibroblasts. So it became the attention of everyone who wanted to understand how this small virus could cause cancer. And here I am in 1979, still have the beard. Yeah, I think it's just beginning to gray here. So that process has continued for the last 40 years. So why did we do experiments that led to the discovery of tyrosine phosphorylation? Well, we were following the lead of Mark Collette and Ray Erickson, who had reported the surprising finding that VSARC, the transforming protein of the RNA tumor virus, RAS sarcoma virus, has an associated protein kinase activity, which they thought could be a mechanism for transforming cells from a normal state to a cancer state, because protein phosphorylation was already known to be a way of regulating protein function. So we and several other groups actually were excited by this possibility that unscheduled protein phosphorylation could be a common mechanism for tumor viruses. And so we set out to test whether the polyoma middle T protein had an associated kinase activity, which we did by immunoprecipitating the 3T antigens from polyoma virus infected cells, either labeled with S35 or P32 in vivo. And you can see here are the three proteins, large T, middle T, and small T. Only large T is heavily labeled with phosphate, not middle T. But we also carried out an in vitro kinase activity on the immunoprecipitate, where we added gamma P32 ATP to the beads and incubated under kinase assay conditions for 30 minutes and ran that out on the gel. And you can see a strongly P32 labeled band appeared, much to our delight. And what was important was that we had, three mutant polyoma viruses which do not transform cells, and their middle T did not show any associated kinase activity, correlating kinase activity with transformation. So as I said, other groups had the same idea, and the three groups who had shown that middle T had this associated kinase activity, Alan Smith and Mike Fried at ICRF in London, Brian Schaffhausen and Tom Benjamin at Harvard, and my colleagues Walter Eckhart, Marianne Hutchinson, and I, all attended the 1979 Cold Spring Harbor Symposium on Tumor Viruses in May of 1979. We talked, we presented our data on the kinase, we talked and agreed to submit our papers to Cell when we got back. So for the younger members of the audience, it was just as hard to get papers published in Cell in 1979 as it is now. And these were the three reviews we received on our paper. None of them were complimentary, I should say. These two findings force one to seriously consider the possibility that the activity is an artifact. Okay, that's not so good. The product of this in vitro kinase-like reaction, phosphoserine, etc., wasn't characterized, and with the very low reported activity, it could have been an adenylation reaction. Reviewer 3 was the most damning. Unfortunately, very few of these conclusions drawn by the authors are actually clearly substantiated by the data. So you would have thought this merited an outright rejection, but the editor of Cell was the founding editor, Ben Lewin, and he made the decisions and not the reviewers, as is the case today. Anyway, I knew he offered us the possibility of submitting a revised version, but even before we got the reviews back, which was on July the 9th, I realized that one of the reviewers would certainly ask which amino acid was getting phosphorylated, and so these are the notes from my notebook in the days when I did experiments. Note, this is European convention date, so 12th of June, Nature of phosphate in 60 kT phosphorylated in vitro. So I carried out the kinase reaction. And now, to identify the phosphoramino acids, you isolate the middle T band, labeled band, from the gel and elute it and then hydrolyze it in 6-normal HCl. pH 2, this is, for I think it's back here somewhere. 6-normal HCl, 110 degrees for 2 hours. And then ran out, dried down, and ran out the hydrolysate. So this was what I was doing. So I was trying to determine the amino acid specificity of the in vitro label middle T. And the goal was then to separate the released phosphoramino acids by at pH 1.9 on a cellulose thin layer plate using added unlabeled, misspelled here, phosphoserine and phosphothreonine standards. Then we could stain for the phosphoserine and phosphothreonine, which is what we assumed it would be, one of the two, and then expose the film, the plate, to an X-ray film to detect the P32 label phosphoramino acids. So here is the result, the X-ray film from the first exposure of that first experiment, June 14th. Now, I don't suppose any of you can really see anything on that order radiogram, but with the eye of faith, I could see a spot here, and it certainly wasn't co-migrating with either phosphoserine or phosphothreonine. So what do you do? Well, you put it down for a longer exposure, and now it became quite clear that there was a strong radioactive spot that ran between phosphoserine and phosphothreonine. Okay, so could have been some giant artifact, right? But this is, in the end, what turned out to be phosphotyrosine. Now, I was trying to guess what it might be, and luckily I had trained as a biochemist, as Hugh told you, and I knew there was a third hydroxyamino acid, as did Fritz Lippmann, actually, and I had drawn out the structure of the R group of tyrosine in my part one biochemistry class in 1962. So here it is. This is the hydroxyl, phenolic hydroxyl group. And I noted in my lab book, spot does not coincide with phosphoserine or phosphothreonine markers. So obviously, you really need to repeat the experiment to see if it was an artifact or was real. And we did that and got the same results. So that seemed, you know, that it was reproducible. And it was stable, whatever it was stable to acid hydrolysis. And this suggested it might be another phosphate ester, which could be phosphotyrosine. So what I was inferring was that maybe instead of phosphorylation of the beta hydroxyl group of serine and threonine, phosphate was going on to this phenolic hydroxyl group of tyrosine. But I needed some phosphotyrosine marker, and I couldn't go to Sigma and buy it because it wasn't there. So I needed to try and make some, and I'm not a chemist, I'm a biochemist. And so what I the way I tried to do it was to mix phosphorus oxychloride with tyrosine in water. And any chemists in the audience will know that just creates a black tar. However, I was successful in isolating a little bit of a soluble compound that had the properties of phosphotyrosine. And I ran this out on July the 2nd and saw a faint anhydrin staining spot that migrated between phosphoserine and phosphothreonine. So instead of following up on that, on July the 3rd, a group of us from the lab drove to Idaho to raft the Salmon River, which was an 8-day trip, about, 100 miles on the river. And then flew directly from Salmon, the town Salmon, from Idaho to Cambridge to attend the DNA tumor virus meeting, and didn't get back to La Jolla until August the 6th. Here I am, rowing, in fact, this river with our own equipment. So when we got back and got into the swing of things again, I developed a two-dimensional separation for phosphatidylserine, serine, and tyrosine, electrophoresis at pH 1.9, and chromatography, and you see a clear-cut radioactive phosphatidylserine spot. And so we used those data to resubmit our paper to Cell on September the 25th, and here's the title. Now you'll note that it was accepted on September the 27th, so that means that it wasn't re-reviewed. Ben Lewin, in his wisdom, decided to accept our paper without further review, as were the other two papers, who apparently had not been asked to identify the phosphoamino acid or didn't manage to do so because we were the only one who had discovered the tyrosine phosphorylation of middle T. Now, there's a bit of history to this. So the only reason that I was able to stumble on phosphotyrosine was I'd simply been too lazy to make up fresh electrophoresis buffer. And it turns out that pH 1.9 buffer, which is a mixture of formic acid and acetic acid, slowly loses the acetic acid with reuse, it evaporates, and the pH drops to pH 1.7, the pH of formic acid. And in fact, this simple drop of 0.2 pH units causes phosphotyrosine to resolve from phosphothreonine. So there's a lot of luck involved. And later on, Sarah Courtnage showed that the polyamide middle T associated tyrosine kinase is due to an association with the C-Src tyrosine kinase rather than being an intrinsic activity of middle T. But there was a second stroke of luck, and that was at the same time Karen Beeman in the lab was using RAS virus for various purposes, but in particular, we were using it to study the kinase activity that Ray Erickson had reported. And one day, doing some final experiments for the paper, this was just before we resubmitted, in fact, I was doing a complete proteolysis of middle T to show that release phosphotyrosine, so it wasn't an artifact of acid hydrolysis. I ran out the Src kinase reaction where the heavy chain of the antibody gets phosphorylated. And much to my amazement, this also proved to contain phosphotyrosine. So it was very easy to go on and show then that Src actually phosphorylated the heavy chain on tyrosine with a two-dimensional separation. And perhaps more importantly, by using RAS virus-infected chick cells labeled with P32 in vivo to show that the uninfected cells had a very low level of phosphotyrosine and massive amounts of phosphothreonine and serine, whereas the transformed cells with VSARC had about a tenfold increased level of phosphotyrosine in protein, consistent with the VSARC kinase phosphorylating other cellular proteins. Now, it turned out that Src autophosphorylates on tyrosine, and so it was the very first known cellular phosphotyrosine-containing protein. The P32 labeled Src protein contains two triptych peptides resolved on this map, and the beta peptide upon hydrolysis was found to contain phosphotyrosine. This turns out, for those of you who know, to be the tyrosine 416 autophosphorylation site. Now, another key experiment that actually wasn't included in the PNAS paper because there wasn't room was this one, where we used a mutant form of RAS virus that's temperature sensitive and only transforms cells at 36 degrees. are not at 41 degrees, and when you shift transform cells grown at 36 degrees to 41 degrees, the cells flatten out and become non-transformed. When you do that with P32 label cells, you can see that the large amount of phosphotyrosine rapidly diminishes within 30 minutes of shifting the cells, and the kinase gets shut off, and immediately cellular tyrosine phosphatases begin to dephosphorylate all of those SARC target proteins. So that's what this says. So we submitted this paper on RAS sarcoma virus to PNAS. And in those days, you couldn't simply submit it. You had to find a member of the National Academy to submit the paper for you. And luckily, my colleague, Bob Holly, across the corridor from my lab, agreed to do this, and he sent it out for review and got three reviews back. And these were complementary, so the findings are both interesting and potentially extremely significant, in that phosphorylation of tyrosine is normally a rare event. In fact, it's never been shown. The primary significance of this work derives from the fact that phosphorylation of tyrosine is such a novel activity. And here's a nice handwritten review. In those days, the review sheets were carbon copies. And this was, we know who this was, John Holland at UCSD, and he basically said, no revision necessary, immediate publication, strongly recommended. So we submitted the paper to Bob on November the 12th, communicated after review and revision to PNAS on December the 4th, but it now took 4 months for this to come out. In the interim, I had spoken at a meeting in Basel on protein phosphorylation in December of 1979, and Ray Erickson was in the audience and copied our experiments and was able to publish them, his results, before our paper came out in Nature in February of 1980. But still, I think we got the credit. Now, amazingly, all the experiments in the cell and PNAS papers were done in less than 5 months, and everything was replicated several times in most cases. And all the experiments that went into the PNAS paper were completed in less than a month. And if you want a blow account of what we did, it's in this perspective, published a few years ago. So that's the history, a lot of luck involved. Turned out to be, at the time, we really didn't know how important it was going to be. We had a virus, we had two viruses, maybe it was only viruses. Then we showed that the cellular SARC protein also has tyrosine kinase activity, and then, as you'll see, there was a veritable explosion of additional tyrosine kinases, even in human cancer cells. So I was sort of now hooked. I was going to work on protein phosphorylation and have been doing so for the last 5 years now. At about that time, the first predicted protein sequences of tyrosine kinases began to emerge, mostly from retroviruses that had captured cellular tyrosine kinase genes, starting with SARC, but yes, figure able, etc. And I began to align these sequences by eye, so BB here stands for before blast. And it was clear that there were patches of sequence that were related in all of them, but importantly, three serine threonine protein kinases had been sequenced the old-fashioned way. In other words, the protein was sequenced and not the DNA. And these patches of homology were also found in the serine threonine kinases. So I've called this Stone Age bioinformatics, and it led to the realization that all serine threonine and tyrosine kinases evolved presumably from a common ancestor and contain motifs that turn out to be key for catalysis. And this motif in particular, the HRDL motif, is distinct between the tyrosine and serine threonine kinases, allowing one to predict ahead of time whether a new kinase-like protein would phosphorylate either tyrosine on the one hand or serine threonine on the other. So it may amuse you to see that the first place in which a kinase sequence alignment was published wasn't in a regular journal, but rather in the Scientific American, in an article I wrote on the proteins of oncogenes in 1984. And then subsequently, John Cooper and I published a slightly expanded alignment in Annual Review of Biochemistry, which, again, is probably not a real journal, but that's where they were published. So in the end, it turned out that the eukaryotic protein kinase domain has 12 subdomain motifs organized along the length of the catalytic domain, which is usually around 300 residues, although can have inserts. It can either be an entire protein like CDC2 or PKA, or part of a larger protein like the EGF receptor where it's in the cytoplasmic domain. And it turns out, not surprisingly, these motifs are key to catalytic activity, and when mutated, the kinase loses its activity, and most of them line the catalytic cleft of the bilobate catalytic domain structure, first solved by Susan Taylor at UCSD, now over nearly 40 years ago. And here is a bound ATP molecule with the phosphate poised to be transferred to a substrate which binds to this C-terminal lobe here. A mutation of the catalytic aspartate in that RDL motif kills catalytic activity. So we had the first tyrosine kinases in 1979, BSARC and CSARC. By the end of 1980, a lot of other people with retroviral oncogenes had jumped on the bandwagon and had shown that VABLE, VFIPS and VFAS had tyrosine kinase activity. And perhaps most importantly, Stanley Cohen, who had reported the EGF receptor was a threonine kinase, revisited his observation and showed it was actually a tyrosine kinase, is immediately linking a proliferative signal to a viral transforming signal. And in that regard, a couple of years later, via B, the transforming protein of AEV was shown to be derived from the EGF receptor. So by doing these alignments and by people using those motifs for PCR amplification, a huge number of novel protein kinase sequences were published within a short time in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And this curve was sort of growing exponentially, both the total protein kinases and the tyrosine kinases. And so I rather rashly predicted in this review in Cell that the kinome, the collection of all protein kinase genes in an organism, might be as many as 1,001. Now, it turns out it is a somewhat of an overestimate from the human kinome, which is only around 535 protein kinases. But there are kinomes, particularly plant kinomes, like the eucalyptus tree that grows around the Salk Institute from Australia, has 2,500 kinase genes. So huge number of protein kinase genes in most eukaryotic organisms, particularly in plants. So when the human genome was completely sequenced, it was possible to then survey the predicted gene products to look for protein kinases, and the work of Gerard Manning and colleagues at Sugen, together with me, were able to complete the human kinome. 478 of the predicted kinases could be arrayed in this tree in seven major branches, with the tyrosine kinases on top, of course. This is the PKA basophilic kinase branch, the proline-directed kinase branch, and the calcium calmodulin-regulated kinase branch. There are also a small number of atypical protein kinases, but particularly important are the PI kinase-related kinases. These are huge, ancient kinases, many of which recognize DNA and RNA damage. That's ATM, ATR, DNA PK, and SMG1, but also mTOR, the energy-sensing kinase of all eukaryotic organisms. These have a kinase domain that's distantly related to the more classic kinase domain. Turns out about 10% of these total 518 protein kinases are missing key catalytic residues, and we call them pseudokinases. Many are conserved. They seem to serve scaffolding functions in many cases. We fast forward another 15 years or so. Kinome 2.0 We're up to 535, but all 20 sort of new kinases are remote or atypical kinases, but they do include an important kinase, FAM20C. It's a secreted protein kinase. It lives in the lumen of the Golgi and phosphorylates secreted proteins like casein. So this is the true casein kinase. And then the enemy family of histidine kinases that I'll talk about next time. So when I was going around talking about with some of the first trees, there was a speaker at the meeting who drew a cartoon of every speaker, and he drew this cartoon of me with kinases dribbling out of my beard. I probably have more than 1,001 beards, but hairs in my beard, rather. Now, to counteract that larger number of kinases, there are a large number of protein phosphatases now in 10 structural families, not really in one major family. I won't go through these because it's not really pertinent, but I will point out total number of catalytic domains is around 190, that many of these phosphatases, particularly the PP2A catalytic subunit, can form a variety of phosphatase complex with regulatory subunits, and there are 110 phosphotyrosine phosphatase family members to counteract the 90 tyrosine kinases. So about 4% of all human genes are kinases and phosphatases, underscoring the importance of this modification. So by the end of 1990, over 50 tyrosine kinases have been identified, and we now know there are 90 tyrosine kinases. We did wonder whether Y2K might be a new tyrosine kinase, but of course that turned out to be a fake in the end. So here are the 90 tyrosine kinases. The first tyrosine kinase, SARC, here, and a family of 8 non-receptor tyrosine kinases. 58 of these tyrosine kinases are receptor tyrosine kinases. They span the membrane once with an N-terminal ligand binding domain outside. And this is the largest family of receptor tyrosine kinases, the EPH family. But there are some other really important families, the insulin receptor family, the FGF receptor family, and somewhere in here, the EGF receptor family. So over half of these are implicated in cancer through activating mutations or overexpression. And altogether, more than a third of protein kinases have been implicated in disease through mutational analysis, through suffering mutations or amplification. And even the tyrosine phosphatases are known to be mutated in cancer. In this case, an activating mutation of the SHP2 tyrosine phosphatase. Now, because of the finding that tyrosine phosphorylation can be a driver in cancer, there was a lot of interest starting in the 1990s in generating small molecule inhibitors that could be used for treatment of disease. And as of January the 1st, there are 124 small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors approved for treatment of disease. And of these, 86 are tyrosine kinases. So this is a quite striking outcome of doing simple experiments on a chicken tumor virus. Now, there are many sorts of small molecule inhibitors, but I will point out that there'll be a new class appearing soon, the degrader kinase inhibitors, in which one part of the degrader binds to the catalytic domain, often based on an inhibitor moiety, and the second half recruits an E3 ubiquitin ligase, and these will undoubtedly become extremely important. Here's the first approved tyrosine kinase, imatinib, or Gleevec, which Hugh mentioned. And you can see how beautifully this inhibitor fits into the catalytic cleft of the activated Abl kinase domain. So this is the timeline of approval of small molecule, antibody inhibitor drugs, and I'm not going to take you through this, but you can see, starting with Gleevec in 2001, you can see there's just been an almost steady expansion of the number of approved kinase inhibitors, with new ones that appeared after the drug. This review was published by Atwood et al. In 2021. including the first allosteric inhibitor, asciminib, that inhibits BCR-ABL in another way. And this is a very recent approval, so TYK2, it's a TYK2 inhibitor for treatment of psoriasis, which we in the US see advertised on morning television all the time, so can't get away from them. And this is just to illustrate, so I have 10 minutes to finish with, that progress in science can take a long time. So the journey or the road to Gleevec in 2001 started with the recognition of CML in 1845, discovery of tyrosine kinase activity, and a whole number of independent threads of research were needed to ultimately arrive at this very effective inhibitor. So I need to thank the people who were so important in discovery of tyrosine phosphorylation, particularly Walter Eckhardt, Bart Sefton, and Marianne Hutchins. So in the last 10 minutes, let me turn to some unpublished data on the PIN1 phosphodependent prolyl isomerase. So this is a small isomerase. Here's its structure that we solved in 1997 that contains a WW domain. It's around a 50 residue phosphobinding motif that recognizes phosphoserine 3-aline proline motifs, and a catalytic domain that catalyzes cis-trans isomerization of phosphoserine 3-aline proline motifs. So here's the first paper. We stumbled across PIN1 like in many things one does accidentally through a 2-hybrid screen carried out on a protein kinase from Aspergillus called NIM1. This was the work of Kunping Liu in the lab, who went on to characterize PIN1, show that it's a highly conserved protein and that it plays a role in human disease. In particular, PIN1 has been shown to be overexpressed or overactivated in many human cancer types, correlating with poor outcome in cancer. And it's been found to be important in many types of cancer, either activating oncoproteins or inhibiting tumor suppressor proteins. Now, I'm not going to take you through this because there's too much written down here, but I will say it is conserved in all eukaryotes, but it's not an essential gene, which is surprising. The knockouts in yeast, fish and yeast, Drosophila and mouse, have modest phenotypes. So there are mice walking around without PIN1. Whereas it is essential in budding yeast. And PIN1 selects proteins via its WW domain binding to phosphoserine 3-aline motifs, allowing it to isomerize phosphoserine 3-aline in the same protein molecule. And cancer-associated proteins like P53 and MYC are important PIN1 targets. And as I'll tell you, there are small molecule PIN1 inhibitors that are now being developed. So Shui Wang in the lab decided she wanted to study whether PIN1 plays a role in human bladder cancer. We haven't been working on PIN1 in the lab for about 25 years, so she just decided this would be an interesting project. There are two types of bladder cancer, non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive. The muscle invasive ones are the ones that progress and cause high patient mortality. What she showed using immunostaining and single cell RNA-seq is that PIN1 predominantly localizes in the luminal urothelial layer in the normal bladder, and that PIN1 positive cells have higher rates of proliferation. And again, RNA and protein are highly expressed in luminal cells in the muscle-invasive bladder cancers. So she knocked out PIN1 in a human bladder cancer cell line and then re-expressed PIN1 in those same cells and showed that loss of PIN1 causes a significant delay or slowing of proliferation and also causes defective scratch wound migration. Just look at the DMSO lanes here where the knockout of PIN1 severely delays migration of cells into the scratch wound that was restored by re-expression of PIN1. And we obtained similar results with another bladder cancer cell line. Tumorigenesis with the knockout control and rescue line showed that the knockout caused a severe delay in tumor growth, restored by re-expression. And this was in a flank, subcutaneous flank model in nude mice. And in an orthotopic model where cells are instilled into the female bladder, again, loss of PIN1 results in significant growth delay. There is a covalent PIN1 inhibitor that was recently reported called sulfopin. Treatment of the wild-type bladder cells causes a significant decrease in proliferation, starting at around 3 micromolar. Interestingly, though, the inhibitor doesn't have effect on the slowed proliferation of the knockout cells, consistent with the effects of the inhibitor being on target. And treatment of, in this case, subcutaneous tumors with mice with subcutaneous tumors with sulfopin 3 times a week showed a significant delay in growth, but not the growth of the knockout, the delayed growth of the knockout cells. So what is PIN1 doing in these cells? Well, RNA-seq analysis suggested that cholesterol metabolism could be a target for PIN1. It, the expression of several genes in the biosynthesis pathways were reduced in the PIN1 knockout cells. And that led us to examine whether there were changes in the level of cholesterol, and you can see a strong drop here in the level of total cholesterol in these cells restored by re-expression of PIN1. And treatment of these cells with simvastatin, an inhibitor of cholesterol biosynthesis, it inhibits HMG-CoA reductase, cause a growth, a deficit in the growth of these cells. So what could the target be in the cholesterol biosynthesis pathway? We looked for possible PIN1 target phosphorylation sites and enzymes and regulators of the pathway, and ended up focusing on SRBP2, the transcription factor which upregulates the expression of the enzymes in this pathway, the master regulator, but only when cholesterol levels fall through a cholesterol-inhibited protease processing event that releases the N-terminus of the transcription factor from its ER resident precursor to move into the nucleus. So this is SRIBP2. In the absence of cholesterol, there are 2 cleavage sites that release this N-terminus, which has a BHLH zip DNA binding domain here. And what Shui showed was that SRIBP2 and PIN1 co-precipitate when cells are stimulated with TNF-alpha, which activates JNK MAP kinase. And you can see that here, co-precipitation that's lost when the cells are treated with either of 2 JNK inhibitors. And we mapped serine 455 lying close to the cleavage sites as a possible binding site, which when mutated to an alanine reduced PIN1 co-precipitation. Finally, Shui showed that treatment of, this is a flank again, a flank subcutaneous tumor model, that treatment with a combination with either sulfopin, the PIN1 inhibitor, or simvastatin, the HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor, or a combination of them slowed the growth of these tumors, with the combination being more effective than either, suggesting some sort of synergism. So our model is then that in response to TNF and anything else that activates JNK, PIN1 can bind to JNK phosphorylated SRIBP2. We think this may result in conformational change that perhaps facilitates the cleavage by the proteases, and that this results in expression of cholesterol biosynthesis pathway enzymes, that an increased level of cholesterol is important for the tumor growth of these cells. However, we suspect that PIN1 is doing many things in these cells and not just facilitating or increasing cholesterol biosynthesis, and probably there are many other proliferative and invasion pathways that are also activated by PIN1. So our results suggest that maybe bladder cancer would be a good target for a PIN1 inhibitor if one is approved for clinical use and could be used in combination with a statin like simvastatin. So with that, I'll thank the people who did the work on this project, initiated by Kung-Ping Lu, now at Western University in Canada, who's still working on PIN1, another 30 years later, Shui Wang in my lab, Derek Lee at UCSD, and Haibo Xu at Shenzhen University. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.